I'd like to welcome you all on behalf of USIP and all of us here, I guess, for what promises to be a really fascinating discussion of the Cuban Missile Crisis and lessons for the war on terror. This is the fourth in our series of Senior Fellow Project Reports this year. These events are opportunities for us to hear more about the fellows' work and also for the fellows to get feedback from the USIP community and broader Washington policymakers. The schedule of the remaining project reports is outside on the table if you're interested in coming to other events. As is customary, Michael Goss has prepared a paper for today's discussion, which is available outside. His paper includes excerpts from the book manuscript, which he completed here as a fellow this year for Knox, called 1 Minute to Midnight, October 27, 1962. His research for the book entailed searching archives in the United States and Russia, interviewing ground troops and policymakers around the world, poring over maps and satellite images, some of which you may get to see today, and carefully studying declassified documents. And if you think that everything that could be said about the Cuban Missile Crisis, which after all took place 45 years ago, has been said, you're in for some surprises today. Michael's book will shed light on what was really happening when the world stood on the brink of nuclear war in the most visible showdown of the Cold War. The work of Michael Goss contributes to USIP work related to Cold War, conflict management and resolution, and negotiating behavior. In this regard, I would signal Kenneth Jensen's book, Origins of the Cold War, published by USIP Press, and a book written by former senior fellow Mel Lefler on why the Cold War ended, forthcoming this year from Farrar, Strauss, and Giroux. In today's talk, and in a special report Michael Goss is authoring for USIP, Mr. Dobbs draws parallels between conflict management and mitigation practices during the period leading up to and during the Cuban Missile Crisis, and the pressures and dilemmas that confront modern-day presidents facing major foreign policy crises. Michael Goss' experience as a seasoned reporter equipped him well to reflect on these issues. Michael was the first Western journalist to visit the Gdansk shipyard in August 1980 and spent much of the 1980s covering the collapse of communism, reporting from Poland, Eastern Europe, and Russia, as well as China during the Tiananmen uprising. Mr. Dobbs has been a national reporter for the Washington Post for 14 years, serving as Moscow Bureau Chief, Paris Bureau Chief, Eastern Europe Bureau Chief, and also as a freelance journalist in Africa and Eastern Europe. He's held fellowships at the Woodrow Wilson Center, at Harvard University's Russian Research Center, at Princeton University, and he's the author of numerous books, including Saboteurs, The Nazi Raid on America, Madeleine Albright, and Down with Big Brother, The Fall of the Soviet Empire. Before turning the podium over to our speaker, I'd like to note our customary disclaimer that Michael Goss' remarks do not necessarily reflect the policy of the U.S. Institute of Peace, which does not take policy positions. I'd also like to say a word of thanks to those who helped with the setup and organization of this event, especially Michael's research assistant, Chris Holbrook, who's working on his PhD in the Department of Government at Georgetown University, and Stefan Ford, who's not here, but who's responsible for the setup of the room. Finally, I would ask that you turn off all your cell phones and any other electronic devices that you have with you. This is not just about interruption during the talk, but we do have this talk will be recorded, and the recording system will be interfered with if your device is allowed. So we ask you not just to silence them, but to turn them off. And without any further ado, I'll turn the podium over to Michael.
Well, thank you very much, Jenny. I want to thank the USIP for making my project possible. I've been working on it for a year before I came here to USIP, but it's a two-year project, and I certainly needed support for the second year. Not only the financial support, but the intellectual support that you can get from being a fellow at USIP. So I'd like to thank particularly Jimmy and Chris for helping me with the project, and they're now actually reading the result, which is 600 pages of manuscript, which will probably boil down to 300 or 400 pages. I'm glad this is a fairly small group because I've sort of got quite a few. I've been quite technologically ambitious, and so please bear with me if some of the technology doesn't work immediately. But I want to show a little bit of a film, audio clip, and some photographs as well. I'll just talk a little bit about my approach to the book, though, first. I first, I guess, really started getting interested in the Cuban Missile Crisis when I was covering foreign policy for the Washington Post during the lead-up to the war in Iraq. And, of course, we couldn't get inside the Oval Office at that time. It would have been fascinating to have been a fly on the wall during the discussions. But I wanted to get a feel for how presidents made the kind of that kind of decision about how to go to war. And the best precedent was, the Cuban Missile Crisis and the very detailed tapes and transcripts that we have of what took place in the Oval Office during the 13 days of the crisis. And you see a very kind of intimate back and forth between the president and his advisors, completely unvarnished language, thrashing out these issues. So I began with that and actually wrote a couple of pieces for the Post at the time, looking at the parallels between, or sort of drawing lessons from those tapes. But then having done that, it sort of quickly became apparent to me that you can't understand the build-up to the war in Iraq just by looking at what happens in the White House. Or you can't understand the war in Iraq just by looking at what happens in the White House. And you can't understand the Cuban Missile Crisis but just by analyzing and studying those tapes, even though they're extraordinary documents. You have to create a larger context, because decisions that are made in the Oval Office don't necessarily get carried out on the ground, as we've seen in Iraq. So the tapes by themselves don't really tell us very much unless you know what's going on the ground. I was particularly, I thought the area that I could break most new ground was actually the Russian side of the story. Over the last 10 years, there were 40,000 Russian troops on Cuba in October 1962, and they've been telling their stories. It's possible to talk to them. There are organizations in Russia which have been collecting their oral histories. Many of the documents have come out from the Russian side, not as much as from the American side, but it's possible to tell the Russian story of what happened to the nuclear weapons there, how they were handled, how they might have been fired, in a way that it wasn't just a few years ago. And I found that by taking the approach, or combining the approach of a scholar and a journalist, I was able to actually break a lot of new ground. By the scholarly approach, I mean sort of examining documents, going to archives. But sometimes, even documents don't tell the truth. Or the documents just give you a hint of what took place. And in order to fill out the story, you need to actually go and talk to people. And conversely, people's memories 40 years later can be very misleading and often erroneous. So in order to use these oral history interviews, you need to check them against the facts, check them against contemporaneous documents. Unfortunately, we do have contemporaneous documents to check the Russian accounts, because most of the CIA, US intelligence community was observing, was flying low-level planes, high-level planes, U-2s over Russia all the time, and over Cuba all the time, was photographing everything that took place on an R-to-R basis. And sometimes they didn't even know what they were photographing. Most of that material is now at the National Archives, and you can go and look at it. And, for example, some of the question of how the missiles and how the warheads were moved around Cuba during the crisis. I've talked to the Russians who are actually responsible for moving the warheads and moving the missiles and handling the missiles. But then you go to the National Archives and you look at the US intelligence of what was actually being photographed, and you see that it usually coincides very well with what the Russians are telling you. and sometimes it doesn't completely, and then you can discount the oral histories. But to combine the two approaches, I think, of oral histories and archival documents is essential to breaking any new ground in this really most studied of international crises. Having collected all this material, of course, the question is how to interpret it. And history is always a function of the present. You look through the past through the prism of the present, and this is one of Arthur Schlesinger's great maxims, that in writing history is really about writing the present. And of course, when I approached this project through the with the eyes of somebody who had watched the debate about Iraq unfold. And then as I wrote the book, we saw what had happened in Iraq over the last couple of years. And so inevitably, I started making comparisons between how Kennedy handled that crisis back in 1962 and how President Bush has been handling Iraq. I think there are parallels, there are more parallels than sort of superficially meet the eye between the two men. They're both fairly young when they became president. They both had a fairly ideological view of the world. Kennedy in his inauguration address had talked about defending freedom all over the world and bearing any burden, paying any price. Some of the rhetoric is very similar to the rhetoric used by the Bush administration. They both felt that they were facing an existential threat to American national security. Kennedy's case, the threat of missiles deployed close to American shores, the threat of the rival superpower. In Bush's case, the threat of Islamic extremism, with possibly having access to weapons of mass destruction. So the two moments are really quite comparable, I think. So I want to begin by just looking at the popular presentation of the crisis. And how many of you have seen the movie 13 Days yet? About half of you, but you've probably forgotten the movie. But let's look at just one particular episode. I'll only play a couple of minutes. This is one of the key moments during the crisis on Wednesday, October 24th, when the Soviet ships were approaching the quarantine line, and President Kennedy was faced with a decision of whether or not to order the ships to be intercepted.
Gentlemen, can you hear me?
Yeah.
I've got 1 minute till 10 here.
This is meant to be McNamara.
The quarantine commences in 1 minute.
That's Kennedy at the end of the table. JFK.
And no sign of the stop.
Chief of Casablanca, 030. XO, take a look at this.
New contact, Skipper.
What do we got?
A Russian sub.
7-4, 7-4, all hands in the bed!
Ready 231, Carl, there's our submarine at 9,000 yards. To protecting the freighters.
Well, is there any way we can avoid stopping the submarine first?
I'm afraid not, Mr. President. The sub has positioned itself between the Pierce and the Soviet ships.
Admiral Anderson insists it's too much of a risk to proceed with stopping the freighters. The Pierce would be a sitting duck for the sub.
Put me through the Pierce.
Yes, sir.
Admiral Anderson, the President wishes to speak directly to the captain of the Pierce. Is that a problem?
Oh, it isn't, sir. He's putting it through.
Sir, I'm passing it through
the bridge now.
This is Captain Pierce.
Captain, this is the President speaking.
President?
Is there any way you can force that sub to the surface without damaging it or yourself?
I can bring it up, Mr. President, but whether it's damaged or not is up to the sub.
Even if they do force it up, that sub will be inspected on the cruise.
That's meant to be John McCann.
Maybe executed for a while when they got home.
That's George McFundy. And Bobby, of course. Kenny O'Donnell. Adlai Stevenson, Midland.
Captain, force us up in the service.
Yes, Mr. President. Prepare to fire torpedoes.
Prepare to fire torpedoes. Aye, sir.
Prepare to launch Ezra.
Prepare to launch Ezra. Aye, sir.
Appear to be stopping.
Mr. President.
Reports are coming in here to the Pentagon that the ships appear to be stopping.
Captain, belay that order. Belay that order.
Hold your fire!
Well, where's that coming from?
One second, Mr. President.
Somebody find out what's going on.
Nice, Lieutenant.
The ships are definitely stopping.
Someone's turning around.
Are they stopping? What the hell are they doing?
Admiral? Admiral, what's happening?
Yes, sir, they are stopping.
The reports are coming in from all around. The ships are stopping.
Some are turning around.
Some are turning around.
Oh. eyeball, I think the other fellow just blinked.
That was Dean Raskin, probably the most memorable quote from the crisis. As I'll explain to you later, that practically everything in that scene is historically false. it is the popular conception of the crisis, and a lot of it has been some that you'll find in books like, and it's not just the movie conception. A lot of it, traces of that you'll find in Bobby Kennedy's 13 Days, in Graham Allison's Essence of Decision, and so forth and so forth. This idea of the eyeball to eyeball moment, which didn't happen, as I'm going to explain. But let's just go forward 40 years to Cincinnati, October 7th, 2002, and George Bush is outlining the George W. Bush is outlining the reasons why the U.S. should invade Iraq. I think it's just audio. Okay, so there's a very famous quote coming up, which I'm sure you recognize.
We have seen that those who hate America are willing to crash airplanes into buildings full of innocent people. Our enemies would be no less willing. In fact, they would be eager to use biological, chemical, or a nuclear weapon. Knowing these realities, America must not ignore the threat gathering against us. Facing clear evidence of peril, we cannot wait for the final proof, the smoking gun that could come in the form of a mushroom cloud.
Okay, so we're very familiar with that quote. What many people don't know is what the two lines that came afterwards. When he goes back to 1962 and sort of puts himself in the position of JFK.
As President Kennedy said in October of 1962, neither the United States of America nor the world community of nations can tolerate deliberate deception and offensive threats on the part of any nation, large or small. We no longer live in a world, he said, where only the actual firing of weapons represents a sufficient challenge to a nation's security to constitute maximum peril.
That was an extract from JFK's speech on October 22nd. When he announced the presence of missiles in Cuba and imposed quarantine on Soviet ships going to Cuba. So as you see, the President, President Bush directly invoked JFK's handling of the crisis as justification for his approach in Iraq. And over the next few days and weeks, other members of the administration explicitly pointed to the same precedent. I talked with Tony Rice a few weeks later, and we were talking about the Cuban Missile Crisis, and she, I think that was the quote in the introduction to that paper, but she specifically talked about Kennedy's handling of the crisis as a precedent for when Bush was handling Iran. And Rumsfeld made similar points in public. So it was on their minds, and it was part of the argument for going to war. So what I want to look at is that we have this historical precedent of the Cuban Missile Crisis. And as we all know, you can draw correct lessons from history, and you can draw mistaken lessons from history. So I'm going to draw a few lessons that I think are relevant to Iraq from the Cuban Missile Crisis that have arisen from my study of the events of October 62. And I'll begin with what I think are the mistaken lessons and parallels, and then go on to what I think are the real lessons of October 1962 before the crisis we're facing now. I now want to show you some pictures, so let me try to print this out. This is actually a picture of the the real room, the cabinet room in the White House. Contrary to the impression that you got from that clip that I showed from 13 days, they didn't meet inside the Situation Room down in the basement of the White House. Most of the ExCom meetings were all held in the cabinet room, down the corner from the Oval Office. You see there were 13 people around the table. JFK didn't sit at the end, he sat in the middle. This is Russ next to him, and this is Bobby pacing up and down. But as a result, I think the first mistaken lesson is the lesson that the Kennedy people themselves drew from the crisis, because they experienced these 13 days, very intense 13 days, and from their point of view, the outcome was extremely successful. And they began to believe that they had discovered the key to managing an international crisis. In fact, Arthur Schlesinger, in one of his works about the Kennedy brothers, praises JFK's matchless brilliance with which he handled the crisis, and talks about a sort of carefully calibrated way in which JFK sent signals to Moscow and to Khrushchev. So they began to believe this. And I think it had profound implications and unfortunate consequences when we came to Vietnam. Clark Clifford, who was the McNamara's successor as Secretary of Defense, talked about this, and he said that the architects of the Vietnam War, meaning McNamara and the people around him, were deeply influenced by the lessons of the Cuban Missile Crisis. They thought, this is Clark Clifford talking, that concepts like flexible response and controlled escalation had helped Kennedy prevail over Khrushchev and would work equally well in Vietnam. Their success in handling a nuclear showdown with Moscow created a feeling that no nation as small and backward as North Vietnam could stand up to the power of the US, according to Clifford. They possessed a misplaced belief that American power could not be successfully challenged, no matter what the circumstances, anywhere in the world. Now, one of the reasons why I think that mistaken conclusions were drawn was partly a lack of understanding of what actually took place. So let's look at that eyeball-to-eyeball moment that took place on October the 24th, and you've seen the clip from the movie. Okay, so this is a document that actually was probably on JFK's desk and on the table of the ExCom in the cabinet room on that day, October 24th. I just found it in the US Naval Archives here in Washington. And here you see that ship, the Chemos, that was approaching the blockade line, and there were plans to intercept it by the Essex. Around here, precisely as we've seen in the movie. I put that map over a used as an overlay here of Google Earth, so you can see the actual positions. And this is where the Chemos was on October 23rd. It wasn't there, it was there, it had been there. And Americans were going to intercept it, the US Navy was going to intercept it round about here, just inside the quarantine line. What no research into the missile crisis has actually done before, which seems extraordinary, but it's a fact, nobody has actually bothered to plot where the Soviet ships were at the time. Of course, it's very easy now to do with Google Earth. But on October 24th, when the quarantine was introduced at that moment, 10 o'clock in the morning, when JFK was expecting a confrontation at sea within minutes. You saw from the movie this kind of popular conception of the Kimovs coming within a few hundred yards of the American ships that were meant to intercept it. The Kimovs was not inside the quarantine line at all. It was 700 miles away from the quarantine line. The distance between the closest American ship, the Essex, which was an aircraft carrier, and the Kimovs was not a few hundred yards, as we saw in that movie. And as JFK imagined at the time, and as numerous books about the missile crisis have repeated for the last 40 years, the Kimovs was 700 miles away, at least 2 days sailing away. The Kimovs did not, the Russian ships did not do their U-turn on the 24th, as we've been led to believe. They did the U-turn the previous day, on the 23rd. So there wasn't this eyeball-to-eyeball moment that has been built up in the numerous academic works, in popular movies, never actually happened, because the truth is that Khrushchev decided on the evening of the 22nd, the night of the 22nd to the 23rd, as soon as he heard about the imposition of quarantine by Kennedy, Khrushchev decided to turn his ships around. The orders went out in the early morning hours of the 23rd, and the ships began turning around dawn on the 23rd. So by the 24th, this incredibly dramatic moment in the cabinet room is a reflection of the way American policymakers felt, but it didn't actually happen on the high seas. In fact, that afternoon, John McCone, CIA director, goes back to the CIA, and he writes a note that the Kimovs has actually been intercepted by an American vessel. He somehow convinced himself that there was an interception at sea. There was no interception at sea. And as we can see, there couldn't have been an interception because the Soviet ship had turned around the day before. So why am I telling this story? Partly, I think that shows several things. Firstly, it shows that the policy makers themselves were only dimly aware of what was happening. They themselves concluded that there'd been this eyeball-to-eyeball moment and Khrushchev had turned around at the last moment. But when you analyze it and you look at the Soviet documents and you look at the plot, the positions of where the ships actually were according to the where the CIA later found them to be, you find out that this didn't take place.
Did the Navy later fess up to the fact that their intelligence was that mistaken?
Well, it's an interesting question as to whether or not the policymakers were ever informed or not. I'm unable to resolve that question. The CIA did conclude a couple of days later, and you can find those documents in the archives, that the ships had turned around on the 23rd. I presume John McCone was told that the ships had turned around on the 23rd, but Robert Kennedy, in his book, 13 Days, still repeats the canard that there was this very close confrontation on the 24th. So whether he was told, or whether he wasn't told, I'm not sure. I think this is part of the mythology after the crisis, that there had been this sort of moment when Khrushchev blinked. And so nobody really had much of an interest in correcting the historical record. And I had always assumed that myself, that because I was sort of brought up on the same stuff, you know, watching 13 Days and reading all this stuff, I sort of assumed automatically until I started plotting the positions of the ships that they had turned around on the 24th. It was not until I went back through the CIA's own reporting that, and then confirmed it with the accounts in Russian archives, that I discovered that this didn't take place. It's extraordinary that for 40 years that's been the sort of popular conception.
For whatever it's worth, Harold Brown, who was later a Secretary of Defense, one of his favorite sayings is that the first intelligence reports are almost always wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And, you can look at Tonkin right. Gulf, you can look at Iraq and nuclear weapons, and what you're coming up with is very profound in terms of national decision making. But you can say it was a good thing that the intelligence wasn't the other way around.
Mm-hmm.
Namely, mm-hmm. they thought that the submarine or whatever was 700 miles away when in fact it was closing in.
Well, of course, they did make some mistakes about if you look at the record of the intelligence community in October 62, they got some things right and they got some other things wrong. They were very late in discovering the missiles. But your point is a valid one, which is, and I was also sort of amazed by the amount of information that is coming into the Oval Office that turns out to be incorrect. I'll give you another example, that on the October 27th, which is known as Black Saturday, which is the day I'm particularly interested in, the most tense day of the crisis, there were low-level American reconnaissance planes flying over Cuba, and they were shot at by Cuban anti-aircraft units. And when they were shot at, they came back. And the first reports came into the cabinet room that they had been shot at, and McNamara said they'd actually been hit. Two planes had been hit. In fact, no planes were hit at all. They were shot at, but there was no damage to any of the American low-level planes. So just because the Secretary of Defense comes in and tells the President something, it doesn't mean that it's true at all. And this is another reason why I think you cannot just... There's the whole sort of coverage industry of studying the tapes, which, as I say, are extraordinary documents, but unless you study the broader context and what was actually happening on the ground and check all this information coming into the Oval Office or into the cabinet in this case, you're sort of left with mistaken impressions. I mean, there are many books that have been written that talk about the planes being hit when they weren't hit, based on what McNamara told the expert. This is a picture of the U2. So there are two key moments during the crisis. One is the moment that we've just talked about, this eyeball-to-eyeball moment, the test of wills between the two leaders, which I think had largely been resolved the day before, that neither Khrushchev nor Kennedy had any stomach for going to war over Cuba. The danger did not arise from the clash of wills between the leaders of the two superpowers. The real dangers during the missile crisis arose from everything that begins to happen when you go to war. As Donald Rumsfeld said about Iraq, that stuff happens. Once you go to war, all bets are off, and many unexpected things can happen that cannot be controlled from the White House or from the Oval Office. And on October 27th, Black Saturday, is when things begin to happen, and events start acquiring a momentum of their own and become very difficult to control by either by Khrushchev or by Kennedy. And things start happening that neither of them want to happen, because neither of them fully control their own militaries. And so in a way, this is the I guess one of the main themes of my book is the inability of the two leaderships to control their own militaries and the risks that arise from that. And they're best illustrated by what happened on October 27th. Now, this is a man called Chuck Maltsby. He was a U-2 pilot, and unbeknown to Kennedy, the U.S., in addition to flying reconnaissance missions over Cuba, was also conducting routine air sampling missions over the North Pole, because both sides were testing in the atmosphere during this period, and the U.S. needed to get samples of the Soviet tests. So we were sending U-2 planes to the north, from Alaska to the North Pole, and they collect samples over the North Pole and come back to Alaska. Is that what they were meant to be doing? This guy, Captain Maltsby, on midnight on October 27th, sets off from Alston Air Force Base in Alaska, heads to the North Pole. At least he thinks he heads to the North Pole, but somewhere he makes a wrong turn, and instead of coming back to Alston, he flies directly towards the Soviet Union. Now, in most missile crisis books, you'll find probably this entire episode is mentioned in just a paragraph, and you won't find Chuck Maltsby's name in much of the literature. I've reconstructed, sort of in detail, Maltsby's flight, where he entered the Soviet Union. He spent 1.5 hours over the Soviet Union on the most tense day of the crisis. The following day, Khrushchev writes to Kennedy and says, how are we to understand this? That, you know, both our militaries are on a maximum state of alert, and you send a U-2 over our territory. At this time, you could have easily mistaken it for a nuclear bomber. Eventually, it's a complicated story, which I won't go into here, but eventually the people back in Alaska managed to steer him out of the Soviet Union and back to Alaska, where he landed. This is all Washington time, quite sure. Now, at the same time that Maltsby is over Alaska, a lot of other things are happening. That over the Soviet Union, a lot of other things are happening that neither JFK nor Khrushchev has authorized, and it turns out that they're completely ignorant about much of what is going on. This is another U-2 pilot. His name is Rudy Anderson, flew a reconnaissance mission over Cuba that same day. In fact, at precisely the same time that Maltsby was over the Soviet Union, Rudy Anderson was over eastern Cuba on a photographic reconnaissance mission, and the Soviet commanders on Cuba, without authorization from Moscow, decide to shoot him down just as he is leaving Cuban territory. They're convinced that the Americans are about to invade Cuba, or at the very least are going to attack the missile sites, and they think that this is a final reconnaissance mission prior to an American invasion or an American air attack, and they can't afford to let him get back to the United States with all the intelligence that he's gathered, and so they take a snap decision without consulting Moscow to bring the plane down, which they do with a SAM missile, the same kind of missile that brought down Gary Powers over the Soviet Union a couple of years before. This is the crew that brought his plane down, shot Anderson down from that SAM site in Los Angeles in eastern Cuba. At the same time this is going on, there are four Soviet submarines. It later turned out each equipped with nuclear torpedoes that are in desperate straits in the vicinity of Cuba, and the US Navy is trying to force them to the surface by throwing down depth charges. That drama is taking place at the same time as well. So they're about, and I've only mentioned, you know, the three biggest incidents that took place on October 27th. And that if you put them all together, there's at least a dozen little incidents, any one of which could have triggered a, under certain circumstances, could have triggered a nuclear exchange. And if you add them all together, you sort of get this, you see that, you know, events were getting out of control of either Khrushchev or Kennedy. In fact, when Kennedy hears about the Moltsky flight that a U-2 pilot has been lost over Siberia, he goes to the person who thought brings him the news. There's always some son of a bitch who doesn't get the word. So I think this, I kind of contrast the this moment on the October 27th as the sort of some the moment depicted by Kennedy as there's always some son of a bitch that doesn't get the word. We can't control everything. With the moment on October 24th, the eyeball-to-eyeball moment. And I conclude that, you know, October 27th was much more dangerous than October 24th. Okay, so I won't talk very much about Bush, but essentially, I think that, you know, Bush, the Bush people, when they looked at what had happened during October 1962, and they studied Kennedy's handling of the crisis, the conclusion they drew was derived from, you know, this kind of popular misconception of October 24th and the eyeball-to-eyeball confrontation with Khrushchev. They felt that firmness of an American president would result in the rest of the world bending to American will. When I think the much more pertinent lesson from the missile crisis is the lesson of October 27th, Black Saturday, when neither side can completely control what is going on. So what are the correct lessons from the crisis? You know, the first lesson is this, what I can summarize as, you know, the famous saying of Don Rumsfeld, stuff happens. Once you go to war, anything can happen, and an American president, no matter how powerful he may be, or a Soviet leader, no matter how powerful he may be, cannot completely control their own military. Then there's the question about the quality of the intelligence, which we talked about briefly before. There are some things back in 62 that the CIA got right, and there was other things that they where they made big errors. They belatedly discovered the missiles. This is a picture of one of the intermediate range missile sites in Sagrada Grande in central Cuba, taken by a low-level US Navy plane. where you see the launch pads, you see the fueling tanks. This is that they have given you that intelligence timetable showing precisely when they discovered different weapon systems in Cuba. They first discovered the missiles in October 14th. The missiles had been there for about a month beforehand, so there was a delay of about a month before they discovered the missiles. Partly because of conflicts between the CIA and the Air Force, partly because of the weather problems over Cuba, there was cloud cover, partly because the State Department felt that it was opposed to flying U-2s over Cuba, and the whole mixture of reasons why they were late in discovering the missile sites, but they eventually did. There were some other there were other Soviet weapon systems that they never discovered at all. And they never discovered, for example, the nuclear warheads. They discovered the missiles, but they didn't discover the warheads. This is a picture here, which I've just generated from Google Earth again, of the central Soviet nuclear warhead bunker just outside a place called Bekalkal, which is south of Havana. You can see it in relation to Havana Airport. It's about, I guess, 15 miles south of Havana Airport and about a mile northwest of this little town of Bekalkal. The Americans, U.S. have been flying over this particular facility for at least a year, and they've been watching vehicles come and go, and you can now go and get the reports on the repeated the observation of this place, but they never concluded, they never found out that the nuclear warheads were actually stored there. They thought it was some kind of conventional ammunition storage. This is Bekalkal itself. I just included that because when I went to Cuba, I thought I would visit Bekalkal. This is the kind of rundown village outside of which the Soviets had their central nuclear weapons storage site, with at least 100 nuclear warheads stored there. Another picture of from the opposite direction, looking from the Havana area. The U.S. intelligence never discovered these weapons. These are tactical nuclear weapons. They're cruise missiles. They're called FKRs in Russian, Frontovaya Prilodnaya Raketa. And the Russians had about 100 of them stationed in eastern Cuba and western Cuba. It was not until 30, 40 years after the crisis that the U.S. discovered, the U.S. policymakers learned that in addition to the big missiles that could have hit the United States, there were all these much smaller, shorter range missiles that could have destroyed American beachheads of American invasion troops going into Cuba. They were never discovered by American intelligence at the time. American intelligence also underestimated the numbers of Soviets on Cuba. This is one of the infantry regiments. As you see, they're all sort of dressed in their checkered shirts. The Russians jokingly called this Operation Checkered Shirt because many of the soldiers were issued with precisely the same kind of checkered shirts. But the best intelligence at the time, in the last week of October, was the Russians had about 6,000 or 7,000 troops on Cuba. In fact, there were 40,000, between 40,000 and 42,000 Soviet troops. The two FKR sites were, as I say, here in eastern Cuba, which was, had there been an invasion, this mission of this FKR site in eastern Cuba was to destroy the naval base at Guantanamo Bay. And there was another FAR site here, which would have covered any of the American landing sites from across the Florida Straits. So, to sum up, who won the Cuban Missile Crisis? And I think, you know, it all depends on what time perspective we take. In the short-term perspective, you know, Kennedy is the clear victor. He got what he wanted. The Soviets withdrew their missiles. Kennedy had faced down Khrushchev. Khrushchev and Fidel was furious with Khrushchev for withdrawing the missiles. If you take a slightly sort of longer term perspective, the missile crisis had many unintended consequences. One of the unintended consequences was a Soviet buildup of their own nuclear forces. In fact, a Soviet deputy foreign minister called Kuznetsov comes to America shortly after the crisis and tells one of the Americans that you're not going to, okay, we had to back down this time. This is never going to happen to us again. And of course, the following year, Khrushchev is overthrown in a palace coup in Moscow, and succeeded by Brezhnev, who throughout the late 60s and the early 70s presides over a massive buildup of Soviet nuclear missiles until they attain parity and some would say some advantage in the late 70s. You know, Vietnam was another unintended consequence. I included this photograph because I think it sort of illustrates the humiliation the Soviets felt after Cuba. This is a picture of one of the Soviet vessels leaving Cuba after the after they've been forced to take out their missiles and uncovering the missiles on the deck for American inspection. Many Soviets talk about, you know, that moment of actually showing their missiles, uncovering the missiles to the Americans as a moment of great humiliation. This is the landing beach, again a photograph from the US archives about this place is just east of Havana, where the American Marines would have stormed ashore had there been a US invasion of Cuba. And we might think, you know, for a moment about, you know, what might have happened in such an invasion. This is a Google Earth picture taken from the other side. Havana is down here towards the west. It's about 15, 20 miles from Havana, I guess. And the Marines began to land on this beach here. It would have been like a kind of Normandy-type landing that's being planned. The Cubans have built fences all along the coast. What the Americans didn't know at the time was that in addition to the Cuban defenders, who they thought they could deal with pretty quickly, there was a multi-layered defense system that included tactical nuclear weapons. The first AD was going to land here at Mariel, right next to a Soviet short-range FKR site. Just one shot from one of these FKR missiles could have wiped out an entire American beachhead. There were also other short-range missiles called Lunas. So before the Americans could have got to the main missile sites here and here, they would have possibly encountered they would have encountered Soviet defenses armed with tactical nuclear weapons. Whether or not they would have used the weapons is another matter, but the weapons, these short-range missiles could probably have been fired by a battery commander of the rank of captain or major. even though Khrushchev had issued instructions that the tactical missiles were not to be used without his authorization, you know, we're seeing various things happening without Khrushchev's authorization, such as the shoot down of the U-2 plane. So it's impossible to say whether, in the event of an American invasion, tactical nuclear missiles would have been used or not, but there was a technical possibility to use them. I want to allow some time for discussion, so I'll end up here. But of the three leaders who, the three protagonists of the crisis, Khrushchev, Kennedy, and Fidel, of course, Fidel is the only one who's still around 40 years later, still thumbing his nose up at the United States. But has he won? Is he the victor of the crisis? I mean, in some ways he is, because you know, he's still there 40 years later. But anyone who's visited Cuba, I would argue that you know, Fidel has been the big loser, or the Cuban people has been the big loser. He's taken his country up a historical blind alley. Communism has really been defeated as an idea in Cuba. The U.S. Was unable to overthrow Castro, but it's won something else. It's won the battle of ideas with Castro. And I think this is the lesson from the Cold War in general, is that we discovered at a certain point, I think in October 1962, that it was impossible to defeat the Soviet Union militarily. So therefore the competition shifted to other areas. It shifted to the economic area, it shifted to the battle of ideas, where the United States is much stronger. The Cold War was eventually won not by defeating the Soviet Union militarily, not by killing all the communists, which is an impossibility, but by winning the battle of ideas and playing to the strengths of American society rather than its weaknesses. So I'll wind up then, welcome your discussion, your questions or comments. And I'm sorry I've taken too long with my presentation.
Thank you, Michael. Very provocative presentation. I'm sure there's lots of questions around the table. If you could identify yourself.
Roger Gertman. Just two things. One is, did the Russians have the capability of striking the United States with a nuclear weapon before the crisis? And secondly, how much of a threat to American security really were those weapons? Would they have been used except in case of a general war, in which case all that would be?
You mean the weapons on Cuba?
Yeah.
The Soviets did have long-range strategic rockets in the Soviet Union, probably about, I have the precise figures somewhere, but less than we thought at the time, but they had 30, 40 of them. So they could have, and some of them were in hardened silos, and some were very exposed, and they could have been easily destroyed in a U.S. Missile attack. But we did not have, either before or after the deployment of Soviet missiles in Cuba, the U.S. did not have the capability to win a first strike against the Soviet Union. Because they had, what I'm trying to say is they had sufficient missiles in the Soviet Union, even before October 1962, that we cannot be sure that we would have had a first strike capability against the Soviet Union. Now, the effect of these medium-range missiles in Cuba, the Russians had comparatively few long-range missiles. They had 30 or 40 long-range missiles, but they had lots of these smaller R-12s, they were called, which could go about between 1,000 and 1,500 nautical miles. So as soon as they were deployed in Cuba, of course they became strategic nuclear weapons. So there are about 50, 60 of them in Cuba. So they certainly multiply the U.S., the Soviet strategic threat against the United States. And so therefore, you know, the people who said, well, this is a real military threat to the United States, that is true, that it did increase the Soviet threat. But it did not give the Soviets a first strike capability against the United States. I mean, even with all these additional missiles in Cuba, say they had all been used, and all the missiles back in the Soviet Union had been used, the United States, even in the worst case scenario, would have still retained the second strike capability, larger and more powerful than the Soviet first strike capability. So therefore, and I think this is pretty much McNamara's position, is that even though those deployment of those missiles to Cuba did certainly represent an increased threat, and they could reach American territory in 5 to 10 minutes rather than 15 to 20 minutes, they did not change the basic strategic equation, which was that neither side had a first strike capability against the other. The sort of laws of deterrence still held either before or after Soviet deployment.
I have a couple more questions. This is absolutely fascinating, Mike. Thank you. I wonder if, I mean, you pointed to some areas where, some specific instances where the president was misinformed. Was misinformed about actual events. In your research and going back through the correspondence and the records, did you find any evidence of an effort to deliberately change the version of what was reported? I mean, we have all these accounts that, you know, such and such happened on this day and that day, mm-hmm. including Kennedy's own book on this.
Right.
Was this wishful thinking at some point, or was there an effort that you could detect to actually change the story in order to present a more dramatic account, or an account that seemed to position the United States as the clear victor in and then related to that, you said that one of the unintended consequences of this crisis was the Vietnam War. By that, did you mean that, you didn't elaborate, but by that, did you mean that it increased American self-confidence in its own abilities to the point where we sort of blundered into?
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't say that the Vietnam War was the consequence of the missile crisis. No, I mean, that's obviously far too simplistic. But the mindset that was created, this sort of hubristic mindset, I mean, I think I basically agree with Clark Clifford's analysis that this gave the people like McNamara and the people immediately around him the sort of sense of hubristic overconfidence that they could deal with international threats, and that they had discovered a new language of diplomacy for dealing not only with the Russians but also with people like the Vietnamese. And for example, there's a bunch of people in Harvard and other places that talked about game theory. And the first bombing raids against Vietnam were not designed to destroy Vietnam or to win a war against Vietnam. They were designed to send a signal to the North Vietnamese that we're stronger than you are and that you have no option but to back down. And the problem was that the North Vietnamese hadn't been to Harvard and they didn't sort of play by the same rules. So these signals, which I'm saying, and when you look at the missile crisis, you see that the signals that were being sent back and forth were misunderstood in many cases by the other side. I mean, some were understood, some were not understood. There was a lot of miscommunication going on. But in coming successfully out of the missile crisis, they felt, the people around Kennedy felt, and who knows whether JFK would have escalated in Vietnam or not, that's a sort of unresolved question. But that group of people around him, had this kind of hubristic mindset that they knew how to deal with, they knew how to manage an international crisis. And I think Clark Kelton expresses that very well. And that's, you know, obviously, you can't say that Vietnam is the direct consequence of missile crisis, but there's sort of cycles of hubris. And it is,
there's no spin on it.
Right, but on the question of the spin thing that you referred to your first point, on the one hand, you know, Kennedy did not want to rub the Soviets' noses in. And when Khrushchev backs down, at one point, Kennedy says, well, they ring up some of the networks and they say, don't crow too early about, you know, our great victory, because this could upset the Russians. That lasts for about 5 minutes. By evening, already the networks are crowing. And there was and the most famous sort of example of the kind of spin that you're mentioning was an article that appeared in the Saturday Evening Post a few weeks later by Stuart Alsop and Charlie Bartlett. I think Charlie Bartlett was it Charlie Bartlett was friends with Kennedy?
Yes.
And so basically this article sort of talks a lot about, you know, the showdown between Khrushchev and Kennedy, makes a lot of the eyeball-to-eyeball moment, runs down Adlai Stevenson at the expense of JFK, sort of makes Adlai Stevenson out to be the kind of guy who was willing to countenance in Munich, and JFK is the sort of firm, calm voice. I mean, you know, this goes on all the time. This is sort of normal for any administration. But Kennedy certainly did indulge in that as well. And you know, many years later, we discover by reading the transcripts and listening to the tapes that, in fact, the biggest dub of all on Saturday was JFK himself. He had practically the entire ex-con against him, because the question was whether they would accept the Khrushchev's a letter from Khrushchev suggesting an exchange between the out-of-date Jupiter missiles in Turkey and these missiles in Cuba. And everybody else was telling Kennedy, JFK saying, you know, you'll ruin NATO if you agree to this. And JFK is, you know, in that debate, is actually the most dovish of all his advisors. But we only discovered that, you know, 30 or 40 years later, when we got access to the tapes.
My question also a bit from USIP. That last point you made was one I was going to ask about, because as I understand it, in fact, there was effective trading that U.S. nuclear missiles in Europe, which could reach the Soviet Union, would be withdrawn, and Soviet missiles in Cuba, which could reach us, would be withdrawn, except one would be somewhat better publicized than the other, and one would happen locally with a decent interval in between. So, thinking back to your point that the Bush administration looked at this as a case where, with firmness and resolve, an American president can get his way. In fact, what you had was, with a lot of creative diplomacy, you have a compromise outcome that makes you look not bad.
Right. And of course, that part of the deal was kept secret.
People knew the missiles left, and at the time, the administration said, well, it has no connection to Cuba.
Right. I mean, actually, the administration, the Kennedy people finessed that quite subtly. They wasn't an explicit deal for the reason that, you know, nobody knew how to deal with the Turks.
Right.
They wanted to get the missiles out. They were outdated missiles. Kennedy was not, JFK was not, did not want to go to war over these outdated missiles in Turkey. But they didn't want to tell the Turks. The Turks were kind of attached to these missiles. So the US didn't simply want to tell the Turks that they were going to pull them out. So what happened in the end was that Bobby Kennedy goes to Breland, the Soviet ambassador, on the evening of October 27th and says, time is running out. We need to wrap this thing up. You'll have to take decisions in the next few days, so we're willing to give a non-invasion guarantee. And Breen asks him about the Turkish and Italian Jupiters. And Bobby says, well, if that's the only obstacle left, we intend to take those out anyway. And we'll do so within 3 or 4 months, and we give you our word that we will do so, but it's not part of the deal. So now there's sort of been various arguments as to whether that was a bargain or whether it was an understanding or what.
And whether it actually
affected Khrushchev's final decision. But it's true that it was part of an understanding.
And could I just note, I did think there was a positive outcome. I believe both Kennedy and Khrushchev came out of that thinking, yes, maybe we should negotiate a test ban treaty, that this nuclear situation does require a little bit more.
I think that this experience of coming, you know, very close to nuclear war, how close you can debate, but that had, I mean, JFK himself thought there was 1 in 3 chance, between 1 in 3 and 1 in 2. That might be exaggerated, but that's how it felt. I mean, that had a profound effect on both Khrushchev and Kennedy. And the following year, Kennedy gives this, goes to American University and gives this speech, you know, saying that we all breathe the same air and we all have children and so on and so forth. And it kind of underlined for him there's a huge power that he and Khrushchev had. And you know, that has a human effect on people. You've been waiting a long time.
I love the vision presentation. I haven't seen anything like that before. It was wonderful to see some of the inaccuracies. I was curious, however, in understanding more about the lessons you're drawing from the Cuban Missile Crisis for the war on terror. From what I understand, there are certainly strong arguments, I think you presented some of them today, that the stories that the public heard about the Cuban Missile Crisis were a domestic political spin that didn't reflect accurately what was going on. And my impression is that therefore you're saying something along the lines of the Bush administration used the lessons that were publicly known rather than a true lesson in order to promote the war in Iraq. Is that sort of a brief version of what you're getting at?
Well, it's sort of a crude version of what I'm getting at. Despite everything that's been written about the missile crisis, I would argue that there's been a wrong focus on the missile crisis, of this test of wills between the two leaders, which, of course, there was an element of that during the crisis, but I do not think that was the most, for me, it's not the most interesting point of the crisis, and it's not the risks that the world ran in October 1962 did not derive from this test of wills, because in the end, both Khrushchev and Kennedy wanted the same thing. They were sensible, intelligent, humane people. And they didn't know each other very well, but they both realized they'd got in over their head. They both made mistakes, and also Kennedy had made mistakes with JFK's mongoose policy towards people in general. They wanted to find a way out. But by focusing on that side of the story, the clash of wills, I think we've misinterpreted the missile crisis. And I think the real lesson, particularly in relation to what has happened to Iran, is, you know, this what happened on the 27th, Black Saturday, when, you know, neither leader, it turns out, was fully in control of their own actions.
That's terrific stuff, Michael. The thing that I draw from this is we have to take your lessons learned. I mean, there are 3 or 4 that are extremely powerful and relevant to contemporary events, namely what we've sort of been through. But I would assume the intelligence we're getting is at least questionable. That the signals you send are not received by the other side in the way that you intend. Shit happens, that is, stuff is out of control, that key decision makers can't control and they confuse the situation. I'm sure there'll be lots of other. The problem we have, or almost any country has, is how do you inculcate a culture of crisis management in which these kinds of issues are in the minds of the key decision makers. And then there are other, the whole logic of deterrence, we're all now saying, hey, in an era of suicide bombers, does the logic of deterrence still work? So I applaud you, I think this is really terrific stuff, and how do we roll it into a culture of crisis management?
So I'd just like to get to you before we end, but just to respond to that. And I think one of the ways of rolling something that should be rolled into crisis management is the proper study of history. One of the things that, one of the books that had a great impact on Kennedy during the missile crisis was The Family of August. And he'd read it a couple of months before. It came out in the spring of 1962, I think. And he just read it, and he told all his aides to read it, and he told the military to read it. The Guns of August, as most of you know, is about the origins of the First World War and the way in which the sort of great powers got into this conflict without anybody really wanting to. And there was one quote in it that Kennedy liked in particular, which was, at the end of the war, two German officials are discussing the reasons for the war, and one asks the other, how did we get into this? And the other guy sort of shrugs his shoulders and says, if only we knew. And the lesson that JFK took from that was that, and that he did not want to, for a future generation, for there to be a nuclear exchange in 1962. And for future generations of politicians to be trying to analyze, why the hell we got into it. He wanted to make sure that, if we were going to go to war in 1962, it was something deliberate, and we knew why we were getting into it. And he actually sort of talks about that sort of historical analogy many times, during the crisis. So he had a sense of history, and also, there are two sort of differences between him and President Bush. One is that Kennedy had been a naval officer in the Pacific during the Second World War in his own PT boat. And so he sort of had ingrained in him the idea, because he'd seen it from the bottom up, that not everything that a commander-in-chief says gets carried out and that all sorts of things can happen. And this becomes much more dangerous in the nuclear age. You can make mistakes in a conventional war and even in a war such as Iraq, and the consequences are manageable. But if you make mistakes in a nuclear conflict, that's the end of the world. So I'd say the other difference between him and Bush is that there was a constraint on Kennedy that did not apply in the during the run-up to the war in Iraq. And even though the stakes were very high in Iraq, they were not quite as high as they had been in 1962, when a nuclear exchange could have led to some millions and millions of casualties. And JFK sort of had that in his blood.
I think we've already covered this before, guys. I'm sorry to keep from hearing, but actually, you've already answered about 2/3 of what I was going to ask. But on that general, it brings the Russian memories back, by the way. I was a senior in high school when all this happened, and I remember walking around telling people, oh, the draft agents can go over, they've all been called up. But in the early 50s, besides Guns of August, when there was this sort of big mechanism to set in motion, and maybe they didn't intend to go where they went, but they were authorized at pretty high levels. And plus the possibility, I remember hearing a lot about when I was in that era about this rogue thing possibly happening, individual missile commanders launching things like that. There were a bunch of articles or some stories about overflights, not just reconnaissance overflights, but in the late 40s and early 50s, but of deliberate provocative overflights over the Soviet Union, and when they were not yet, didn't have much of a nuclear
capability yet, and there was some stories about elements in the U.S. Air Force were trying to like basically kick something off while we still had a really dominant position. Did you cover that? Or is there any relationship? That was only 10 years before this happened.
I mean, we've been years, flying throughout the Cold War. The U.S. flew reconnaissance missions around the periphery of the Soviet Union, sometimes going into the Soviet Union. In the case of Gary Parr, going over the Soviet Union, and this was, this was happening all the time. And sometimes those flights were suspended, there were crises. And this is one of the reasons why I think the largely overlooked episode of Moltsky in the U-2, imagine the coincidence, the guy gets lost on this particular day. How this is perceived in Russia. I mean, it was actually kind of on the periphery of Russia, so it's not controlled. He was flying over the missile sites, and the Russians probably figured out that it was a reconnaissance plane rather than a nuclear bomb. But certainly, they were paranoid about their war, and they're even more paranoid at this particular time.
I've heard in the early 50s they were warning that they were not even contemplating their active war plan to actually flying over.
I'm not sure it's going to be 52, though. I mean, the B-52's turned back. And one of the sort of minor inaccuracies in some of the books is that the B-52's did not turn around at their turnaround point, at the fail-safe point. I think there was a lot of discipline over the B-52's at the point.
I'm going to jump in, and we're out of time now, but I'd like to thank you for a wonderful presentation, and thank you for some great questions. I think you've provoked lots of comments. I have a whole list of questions that I'll be talking with you afterwards. Michael is here until the end of July, so for those of you on USIP staff, please feel free to raise your questions that you haven't had a chance to raise here, and I'm sure you'd welcome outside comments as well. So thanks again for coming.